Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Sheldon is a partner at Amherst Partners Birmingham. 20 years experience in corporate restructuring, especially automotives. I call him a leading economic indicator because when he calls me and says business is booming, which he has done recently, that means that people out there are struggling and they're in trouble and they're asking for help and they're asking for a lifeline because they may not make it without professional help. As he gets those kinds of calls, Alana Nickel is getting calls. She's president and owner at Sandler Training at Jerry Weinberg and Associates Southfield. The company is approaching 30 years of helping to build strong sales teams here in metropolitan Detroit. They know how to sell. They know how to teach people how to close the deal. They know how to navigate a changing industry. And that's what's happening today. The calls she's getting are from companies that she didn't get calls from before, and she'll explain that. Joe Jackman is a headhunter. He's the managing director of the Automotive Group and Got Search Group Rochester. Over 30 years experience in the executive search field. Every January, Joe takes a survey of OEM salespeople and he shares it with us on WWJ, and we usually put it on the air during the auto show coverage. This year, there was something very interesting that came out of that survey, and he'll be describing that and talking about that in detail. And my friend and my colleague and partner and co-worker, Jeff Gilbert, our auto beat reporter at WWJ. He's been at the station for 29 years, over 30 years in this market. He does more auto reports every single day than anybody in the world, and that is the truth. He covers the globe with the auto industry, follows them all over with auto shows all over the world, and he knows the people inside and out. His stories and reporting is heard locally on WWJ News Radio 950, nationwide on the CBS Radio News Network, also on our app, radio.com, and the Michigan News Network, which WWJ owns. We get to every station throughout the state of Michigan there. We begin with Sheldon. Tell me what's going on behind the scenes. What are you seeing happening with the companies that we have right here in our economic landscape?
Thanks, Murray, and thank you very much for inviting me here today. It's an honor to be up here. There's a lot of change, as Murray said, in the industry. The electrification and autonomous vehicles are here. But to give you an idea of where it's going, today, roughly, there are 3 million electric vehicles on the road worldwide. I read a research report 2 days ago that by 2040, there will be 300 million electric vehicles on the road. So what does that say about the internal combustion engine, that it will be eventually going away? Interestingly enough, and maybe this wasn't on the forefront of people's minds, but what really has electrification of vehicles on the forefront today is utilities are getting involved. So they're making, if you buy a Chevy electric vehicle or a Leaf or a Tesla or whatever, they will make the apparatus that you put in your garage to hook up the electric vehicles. They'll give that to you because you'll be purchasing more electricity because of your vehicle, sort of like the razor and the razor blades, right? You want the razor blade company, or the razor company wants to sell razor blades and not the razors. So the utilities are now really interested in how they can help facilitate people integrate electric vehicles into their lives. So how does that filter down to the current supply base? Well, if you have an automotive supplier who is supplying parts for the drivetrain or the powertrain or the braking systems in the car, they better be already have changed their technology and developing technology for electric vehicles. So if they haven't, they will become a buggy whip manufacturer after a while. So there's huge change going on, not only with electric vehicles and autonomous, but just the way we transport ourselves. Ride sharing, Toyota is a partner in Uber, GM is a partner in Lyft. You'll see more and more of that. Volvo has partnered with Carnegie Mellon and Uber to develop autonomous vehicles. So you have technological advancement coming out of universities and tech companies in Silicon Valley partnering with OEMs and partnering with the ride-sharing companies, something that 10 years ago we never would have seen.
And so you have to sell differently than we did before, Alana, and that's where you come in. Against that backdrop, what's happening in your environment?
Sure, absolutely. Thanks, Murray. Happy to be here today. Absolutely, the move to electrification in some of these emerging technologies, ride-sharing, automotive doesn't even know where the market's going. A lot of the suppliers that we work with, they're trying to keep up just like the OEMs are. And what it takes to sell an existing technology, so there's a lot of salespeople and sales leaders at the Tier 1s, the Tier 2s, and even the OEMs that are used to selling powertrain. It used to selling existing technologies. What it takes to sell new technologies is very different. It's a different mindset. It's a different makeup of a salesperson. And so a lot of times what we get is people will say, can you take these people and turn them account managers, which is really what they historically have been, into more pursuit, hunter-focused people? And a lot of times the answer is, I can't. We can't. It takes different makeup, different skills. We've got to find different people that are able to do that, to really sell what we call consultatively, which is getting at questioning and really getting to the root of what's going on, trying to figure out the true value, and not the value around the features and benefits that the part or program offers, but really what's the value to the end customer? How are they going to measure it so that we know successful, so that we're positioning things in a way that's important to the end customer, not what's important to us? And it takes different people to be able to do that effectively than the people that have probably been there 20, 30 years selling existing technologies.
Thank you, Alana. And when we talk about different people and the people involved, we're talking about sales reps, account reps, sales engineers, account managers, account executives. And that's where Joe Giacomin comes in, because he surveys those people, follows those people, and places them in the field. What are you finding today, Joe?
Well, I think, you know, just to dovetail on what Alana said, in the old days, you'd have a sales person. I used to always kind of be amazed at salespeople in the automotive OEM market. I service all the OEM suppliers. Anybody that makes a part that goes on the vehicle, since 1980, I've worked with those companies. So I've watched the evolution from, you know, that entire period through the recessions and the whole evolution of the industry. And when I say the word evolution, Henry Ford too used to say the business was evolutionary, not revolutionary. Today it is revolutionary, and sometimes on a weekly basis things are changing. There's new companies coming in. So the salespeople that used to call or had been traditionally calling on automotive, and I've always kind of smiled at it a little bit, because you'd have a person that would call on Ford selling a bumper that was going to go on a vehicle 3 years from now. Okay, so in a sales picture, if that person moved to Kansas City tomorrow and had to go out and be a salesperson, they'd probably starve to death, okay? Because it's a whole different science calling on automotive, understanding the process of testing and regulations and working through the engineering. So it's a different, there's no salesperson on earth like the people that call on automotive. The difference is that it's not just a matter of selling that bumper that's going to go on a Ford 3 years from now. There's whole new technologies coming in, and I think a lot of these companies, as Sheldon had mentioned, you know, what are these companies going to do that are selling pistons, for example? I work with a company that makes pistons. Now, they've already lost business because cars have gone from 8 cylinders to 6 cylinders to 4 cylinders, so their business has been declining just naturally. Now you have electric vehicles. What's a piston company going to do? So what a lot of these companies are doing is trying to take their existing technologies. So in the case of pistons, castings, that's a casting product. So instead of making castings for pistons, they're going to try to make castings for wheels or other parts that might go on an electric vehicle. A lot of the salespeople in these companies don't want to work for those kind of companies anymore. They want to, when we recruit them, they don't want to be recruited for a quote unquote old technology company. They want to be recruited for a something that's going to have some legs down the road as far as electric vehicles, autonomous vehicles, and so forth. So you have a whole dynamic going on there between technology and the candidates available, and we're already in a very candidate-driven market. So it's going to be an interesting dynamic going forward. It's changing rapidly every day. It's not, you know, if I was Mary Barra sitting at General Motors trying to bet billions of dollars on what's going to happen 4 years from now, I don't think I'd want her job. It's not like it used to be. It used to be challenging enough, but they were dealing with demographics in those days and saying, well, how many station wagons are we going to sell in 4 years, or how many trucks are we going to sell? Well, now, you know, will we even have a car? Will people even want to buy a car? So different business.
And everything that we've just said is what Jeff Gilbert reports on every single week, especially what Sheldon was talking about with all of the partnerships that are going on out there, Jeff.
And I, before we even get into a lot of discussion, I think there are a couple of important things that people have to understand about the two topics that have come up now and will come up again and again, and they're always coming up in the auto industry: electrification and automation. And they're probably the two most misunderstood topics. First, electrification means hybridization all the way up to full EVs, but I'm going to talk about full EVs. And here is why car companies are so interested in electric vehicles. And the environment is only one part of it. That's why governments are interested. Car companies are interested in it because they know while EVs are more expensive to make and to build today, in the future, as they get economies of scale, as they get battery prices down, they will be far less expensive to build. They'll be far less expensive to create. The car companies will have more ability to customize them, because when you think about it, an electric vehicle does not have a transmission. It doesn't have pistons. It doesn't have all these parts that we're talking about getting rid of. If you look at the design, and I'm not an engineer, but even I can understand, when Volkswagen walked a bunch of us around their design for their electric vehicle, it is a battery which is underneath the vehicle attached directly to motors on the wheels. It's that simple. So once you get the electronic component costs down, you have got a simpler vehicle, and that's going to cause a massive disruption, not just in the supply base, but at the auto companies. The UAW just finished their bargaining convention, and while they talked about GM plant closings, they are far more concerned about the fact that in the future it will take far fewer people to build an automobile. So all of that is going to be a disruption. Very quickly, on the automated vehicle side of things, we have seen the talk change from earlier. The thought was we would slowly automate the vehicles that we have, and the car companies realize getting to that full level five, as they call it, is far more difficult, and getting people to pay attention while they're behind the wheel of lower levels is also difficult. So what we're seeing now is small launches in areas where the car companies have control of the vehicles. They can monitor them because, let's face it, the average person doesn't know what their tire pressure is. They're not going to calibrate their sensors every day. So in the near term, we're going to see a lot of these robo-taxis pop up in very limited areas, but nobody can tell us, and the car companies are even backing away a bit from the day when you and I can go buy an automated vehicle that takes us anywhere.
Everything that you said relates in one form or another back to the auto supplier base. And Sheldon, you were telling me a couple of weeks ago that the suppliers are being treated now like it's back in 2008. What do you mean by that?
So at the downturn when Chrysler and GM went through their bankruptcy processes, they, along with Ford and others, they were really making their margins on the back of the suppliers. So little insight is that purchasing people at OEMs, their bonus is contingent on the low cost of the supplier. So if I'm supplier A and I can supply something at 10 cents and supplier B at 8 cents, they're going to go with supplier B because their performance is graded on the cost of that supplier. I have literally seen and been part of where an OEM will move parts across the country to a supplier where the transportation costs are more to get it to the plant where those parts are going to than the supplier that's currently supplying that part, that plant, because the purchasing person doesn't get graded, if you will, on the transportation costs, but it's the cost of the supplier to the OEM. So forget the total cost to the OEM, because the transportation costs now have gone up by a multiple of 50 or 100 because you're moving these parts across the country, but that purchasing person has lowered their cost from supplier A to supplier B. So the pressure on suppliers to continually lower their price, and there's a complete absence, not only at the OEM level, but at the large tier one level. If I'm a smaller tier one or I'm a tier two and I need a price increase because material costs have gone up or tariffs are killing me or whatever the case is, to get a price increase today is virtually non-existent. And I can tell you that firsthand. So with the margin shrinking to the smaller tier ones, larger tier ones as well, and the tier twos, their ability to turn a profit becomes harder and harder and harder. So what we're seeing is these companies, let's say they're now 50 million, 100 million, 250 million in revenue, it is becoming much more difficult for them to turn a profit. So They need help. What do we do?
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
And it's very difficult to sell in that kind of an environment. But Alana, no matter what you're selling, talk about knowing the customer profile, because that comes into play in other areas, but especially today as this industry is changing.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's just staggering to me. But I know that it happens. We see it as well, right? I mean, but how ridiculous is that? That we're going to move a part that's going to eventually cost us more, but the purchasing person who's in control of the dance says, well, I met my targets. We reduced the piece price by whatever percentage, right? So understanding the role that purchasing plays is obviously extremely important, but then how are we working with engineering, with manufacturing, and being able to translate what are the needs and what are the implications and ramifications by going with a lower piece price, but now our transportation costs are higher, maybe our quality, our delivery is less, but the purchasing people don't see that, don't care about that. So in order to be successful in the automotive space, we've got to be good at building the relationships on all those other levels. It can't be just dealing with procurement. We can't just be responding to an RFP. If the first time we heard about a deal was when we got the RFP, we're in trouble. The chances of winning that deal are almost none, right? But it's a fishing exercise to beat up the incumbent to make sure that we're getting the best price possible. And we see a lot of organizations, even really large tier ones, that feel that they have to participate, right? On every RFP, they have to play, which takes a ton of resources. We don't see a lot of really good job at taking a bigger picture, looking at what are the real true go-no-goes. Is this worth going after? Because all I'm doing is educating my incumbent on how to lower their price, and it takes me hours and hours and hours and lots of resources to be able to do that. So we see it. That's a weakness in a lot of organizations, but it starts at the top with a political understanding that they feel that they need to participate in every RFP, even when we're not going to win the deal. And that takes a mindset shift to be able to do that, and then to be able to get the intel from the other areas of the customer's organization to find out what's really going on, other than just the procurement person's objective to lower the price.
If you have any questions, raise your hand. We'll get a microphone to you. A question right over here from Rich. While the microphone is coming, very quickly, Joe, let me just ask you about retaining good talent. We're talking about changing the talent, but what about retaining talent?
A lot of it really depends on, what the company's doing. I just saw a statistic yesterday where, especially with millennials, 45%, and I may be off a percentage or point or so, but 45% of the millennials, which are really are going to be our biggest market, look at staying with a company based upon the training that they receive and the advancement potential with the company. So obviously technology plays a role. They don't want to be with a low technology firm, but we're seeing a lot of increase in salaries in the last few years. That I do that study every year. When I first started doing it many moons ago, I think the average base salary for an OEM salesperson was about $25,000 a year. That was in 1981. Last year it was $117,000 base salary average for OEM automotive salespeople calling on automotive. That doesn't include bonuses, commissions, company cars, benefits. So companies are getting pretty creative on salaries. They're getting more creative on signing bonuses, bonus programs. Money alone, though, is not the real retention factor. I think advancement potential, what they're learning, and recognition play a big role, as long as the money's on par.
Great. Thank you, Joe. Rich has a question.
Thank you. As the suppliers are becoming marginalized, as we were talking about a little earlier, do we see a large potential or likelihood or inevitability that we're going to have an upsurge in quality issues, parts being delayed, the launches being delayed, the same problems we ran into before when we experienced this in the 10 years ago or so? Are we just set up to repeat the same mistakes we made before?
That's a great question. There's certain things that cannot happen in the production of vehicles, and that's stopping a line, stopping production of a vehicle, especially when you're looking at vehicles like the Ford F-150 or the new Navigator or Expedition. These are where, in Ford's case, they're making their money. So, and I'll give you an example. So when Ford launched the new Navigator and Expedition, some very key interior parts were taken on by a supplier moving from Tier 2, who was a very successful Ford supplier at the Tier 2 level, to Tier 1. And they were remarkably unprepared for what they were faced in this launch. Well, Ford threw literally millions and millions of dollars to help the supplier get up to speed so the launch wouldn't be delayed. The supplier took on millions of dollars of debt in order to have the launch occur on time. So in the past, in 08, 09, in a certain supply category, there may have been 3, 4, 5, 2 different suppliers. The pendulum has swung completely to the right. Now, almost exclusively, at least with the Detroit 3, there's only one. So you'll see resources that you wouldn't have seen in the past be thrown at keeping production going, keeping a launch on schedule, where in the past, if there was a problem, if I'm the OE, I could have resourced that work to a different supplier. They don't have that luxury now.
We have a question over here.
So employee retention was discussed, but in terms of recruitment, right, and the evolution of what's going on with automobiles, it requires a different type of talent. And we talked about millennials, right, and I know sometimes it's not traditional, right? Sometimes they don't want to work their shift, or they want to do their work when they have to do their work. I observe other things that are going on playing ping pong during the workday. Are you observing any clashes with traditional folks versus, you know, what the millennials want and the new type of talent?
You know, there's a lot of really sharp millennials out there. I think that that's a stereotype. There are some that are really into showing up at 11 in the morning and going home at 3 and playing foosball or whatever. But by and large, including my own kids, one's an engineer, they're some pretty sharp people out there. I think there's a lot of opportunity right now. We talked about the evolution of business and who's coming in. There's a whole host of new companies coming in that's almost going to take it back to where it was in, I think, in Detroit many years ago. You used to have reps, sales reps, that would pick up a line of products, nuts and bolts or whatever, and they'd go into Ford and make a sale, and 14 of those parts would end up on every Mustang, and they become millionaires. And if you look at some of the homes going through Oakland County, a lot of those people are sales reps from the old days. That all went away here in recent years, but the opportunity is coming back because there's so many new companies coming in from China, from Europe, West Coast companies, new technology companies that are going to need real marketing type people, not those people we talked about that are selling the bumper 3 years from now, but be able to go into a Ford or a GM and say, take a look at this new product, and they're going to need those innovators. So I think we're on the cusp of a new growth cycle in the sales and marketing area.
Talk about a new growth cycle here. Jeff, I want to take you back to Monday morning on WWJ. You were talking about a merger in Pontiac that would create over 100 jobs. Do you remember the story?
Barely, but yes, I do.
I told you, he does many stories a day. But what were happening, okay. But it's in the supply chain.
Well, and what you see in the supply chain, and we were just talking about this, Joe and I, as we were walking up here, the definition of auto supplier is changing. I'll fast forward to a story that I did this morning that I actually think is cooler than that. It was on my supplier spotlight feature I do every day. Roush, who is well known for making muscle cars, specialty cars, is teaming up with an agriculture company that is into technology and automation, and they are making automated weeding machines for farms. Now, that is an interesting area you would have never thought of an auto supplier being involved in. But when you put the technology together with what Roush is doing and with what others are doing, it opens new fields. So I think we're seeing a lot more overlap with the auto industry and other industries, particularly technology. I mean, Silicon Valley is dying to get a piece of the auto industry just because it is so big and there's so much money there.
So businesses are coming and businesses are going and suppliers are losing business. Alana, you have talked many times about also knowing what business you've lost and how you can go about getting it back. Part of the whole sales process is if it drops off, try to pick it up and get it back into the basket here.
Yeah, absolutely. So not all business makes sense to go back after, but we have to know for every deal we win, why did we win? And more importantly, why did we lose? And what did we learn? What did we need to do differently? So let me give you an example of maybe business that doesn't make sense to go back after because the likelihood of it is probably not very high. So if we had an issue, let's pretend I'm a supplier and I had a huge supply issue or a quality issue, and that head of quality or that head of procurement is still involved at that customer, they've got a bad taste in their mouth for me and my company. The likelihood of unseating the new incumbent, probably not that good. However, if there's issues where I will be able to get feedback from the field that we know that the existing incumbent has problems, or maybe there's new players in place, or maybe they've got new technologies, new things that that customer wants to do, then it makes more sense to go back after the business. But that is a big weakness that we see in organizations. There is not enough time spent understanding why did we win a deal, and why did we lose a deal, and what do we need to do differently next time, or when does it make sense to go back after that next year program or a new technology, and when doesn't it?
So we're all trying to see exactly where we fit in.
Can I ask a question?
Right,
as opposed to giving an answer? Because I wanted to expand on something that you said, Joy. I want you to expand on it. When you were talking about millennials, and I also have a son and a daughter-in-law who are millennials who work their butts off. They work far harder than I worked when I was younger. are we on the wrong track when we think of millennials as being different? They're just young. I mean, I remember hearing the same things said about us baby boomers in the early 80s when we were starting, and you talk about foosball tables at places. I mean, when you're in that era, you want to hang out at work, and it's kind of a low-cost thing. If you can get somebody to work 12 hours a day instead of eight and spend a half hour of that playing foosball, you're coming out ahead. But, I mean, is it a psychology of youth as opposed to millennials being different?
They are different to a point. There is the stereotype, but they do approach business a little bit differently than the baby boomers or generations prior to that. But they're very smart. They may get more work done in a shorter period of time than some of the same people that work 14 hours a day. You just can't put everybody in one basket, but they're here. It's going to be that way, and we're going to have to deal with the millennials. I think one of the interesting things, and I see it in our own office, we have some really sharp millennials, and we have a bunch of old guys like me. And when you blend the two together properly, that's probably the best of all worlds. Because one of the things that some of the Ford people have told me is that if you get rid of too many of the senior people, they start designing something that didn't work 20 years ago, and there's nobody there to sit around and say, hey, you know, we tried that 20 years ago and it didn't work. So you really kind of need the blend of both. Sometimes I think the millennials rely a little bit too much on technology and not just kicking, blocking, and tackling, and that's something they have to learn. But by and large, I think for the most part, they're going to surprise us and do pretty well.
And just for the record, we didn't have foosball tables when I was getting into radio, but we did have water balloons. I won't tell you that story because I'm not sure if the statute of limitations has run out.
The statute of limitations has not run out on this one. We do have ping pong, and we do have a brand new beautiful basketball court under our roof at the Intercom Communications Studios. We have it right outside the studio from WWJ and WOMC and WYCD. It's on that end.
Really makes us old people angry when we're trying to work. Would you keep that racket down?
But it does bring the staff together, and it is a good diversion, no matter how old you are. As companies are looking to the future, they're spending billions of dollars to figure out where they're going and try to get there. At the same time, they have to fund what's going on today. We know that the business is slowing a little bit. We know, Sheldon, as you were talking about, transportation costs are going up, raw material costs are going up, a lot of things are going up, labor is going up. What about capital? Is capital drying up, especially for the suppliers? Are they able to get the money they need to continue to keep on keeping on?
Yeah, good question. There is a change in the capital markets. So obviously we're in a period of time when from recession to recession, it's the longest in history. And if you go back a year or two, the prognosticators were saying, well, it's another 12 or 18 months. Well, the 12 or 18 months are here, and there's still no recession. And there's always turbulence, like it's coming, it's coming, it's coming. Well, consumer spending, corporate spending, there's really no hard indicators that a recession is coming, but there is a tightening in the capital markets. And the tightening is in loan structure. If a bank was going to structure a loan, let's say, over a 36-month period, they're not going to do that today. And I'm talking a commercial bank like Chase or Comerica or Huntington. They'll structure the loan in an 18-month period because there's a lot of uncertainty of the second 18-month period of that 36 months. So there is some tightening there with the commercial banks. But now there are non-regulated banks that didn't exist 10 years ago. And the non-regulated banks, a lot of them are ABL asset-based lenders, some of them are not. But they are very competitive in terms of the pricing that they're providing into the marketplace. Pricing that commercial banks walk away from, these non-regulated banks are loaning money. So if there's an auto supplier that has been asked by their bank to exit because they're a distressed credit, a lot of times they go to a non-regulated bank and get capital there. So what people need to look for, as soon as these non-regulated banks start to fall, meaning that
there's a lot of default and they're having trouble with their portfolio, then that is a super indicator that a recession is not far behind. But as long as they're out there and the Fed isn't regulating them, money is free flowing.
Are you concerned about a recession?
I mean, not
an economist, but you're on the front line of what's going on in this field.
It's got to come, but you know there are certain banks where I'll see they'll say to a credit, you have to sell your company or you have to exit and go to another bank. And I'm scratching my head saying, why? You know, this is potentially a credit that can be rehabilitated and taken back out onto the commercial floor at the bank. But what their credit committee, their credit policies, and perhaps in the case of some banks like Wells Fargo that has regulators looking down on them given the troubles that they've had, they're just exiting credits. So this year, probably not. But my guess is as good as anyone else's that if we're going to see a recession come in the near term, it would likely be next year.
If something like that happens, Alana, it's so important to have built relationships that you can fall back on, to know what's going on in companies and to have them trust the salespeople, have them trust the companies that they're dealing with.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in a recession, everything tightens, right? So we have to be adding value, and it can't be about price. So we have to be able to build on those relationships, understand why people are buying from us other than just the price that they're paying. We have to understand where, being able to have strategic conversations about where are they looking to cut proactively instead of waiting to be reactive about it.
Jeff.
Yeah, nobody knows when the next recession is going to hit. And we've had such an unusual recovery that I don't think the normal rules apply, because we spent so much of this recovery essentially getting out of the hole that we were in. I don't even know when you can actually see the true recovery started. But one thing to learn from the last recession in the auto industry is when some event happens, and we in the news business know it will, and triggers another recession, I think you're going to see a much deeper fall in vehicle sales than we would normally see, because looking at the last recession, that's what happened, because pent-up demand is all worked out. New car purchases anymore, and I say new car, not used cars, are a want, not a need, so people can postpone those. Financial conditions with long-term loans, things of that nature, mean more people will be underwater. So the conditions are right that when the day comes that the economy does slow down, I think you'll see car sales fall a lot further, faster than they traditionally do, much like we saw during the last recession.
But will the companies be able to handle that? I want to just tell you, read you from Rod Lash. He's an auto analyst at Wolfe Research, New York, voted one of the top auto analysts for, I think, the past 6 years now. He says a typical 20% North American automotive downturn could hit General Motors profits by 60%. But, he says, they're taking steps to cushion that. They're cutting costs, improving earnings from new low-cost emerging market vehicles, benefiting from new profitable pickups. He figures with all of those initiatives, a 20% North American automotive downturn could leave General Motors cash flow about equal to what it was last year, 2018. Bottom line, he says, they're doing the things right now to be able to handle that if something like that happens. Was there another question over here? Yeah, we'll get a microphone over to you. And anybody else who has questions, just raise your hand, even out there in the back. Rob will run around and get to you so we can all hear you.
Okay. Based on what you were just saying, at least the OEMs and the suppliers follow, there has to be that leap of faith to the new technology, EV, which is happening. And they have to let go of their current design and research on engines, transmissions. They have to pull a plug. And it's going to happen, if it happens at all, during times where sales are strong and all that. You don't want to let go of what's currently making money, but you have to. So you're kind of swinging to the new technology while you're releasing the other ones. Some people are faulting that for it selling now. Why would you do that? But isn't there this bubble as they move into the electric where they had to make that choice, they have to build the infrastructure, they're counting on not only that technology being accepted by the public, but being adopted at a fast enough rate that they can survive, and they have to scale down while this bubble is being realized. Are we looking at a massive change in the OEMs and adapting and surviving that leap to the next one? Because they can't have it both ways. They have to let go of the current
technology.
Can I answer
that, Murray? You know, for those that remember when we didn't have color television or when color television wasn't real prevalent, there used to be a time when all shows were not in color. And it was a real dilemma because the networks wouldn't produce more color shows until there were more color TV sets sold, and the manufacturers wouldn't manufacture more color TVs until they produce more color shows. So it was kind of a standoff, and it's kind of what we're in right now is that they're not selling as many electric vehicles right now because the average person doesn't have the convenience where they can charge it anywhere. The charging times are long. They don't have all that technology worked out. It's good if you're driving back and forth to work, but if you want to drive to Chicago, it doesn't make sense. So there's this whole back and forth standoff going on. And eventually, the color TVs were sold, the shows were produced, and now, of course, everything's in color. The big trick is nobody knows when that's going to actually tip, and it is a trick. And if you're, like I said, if you're Mary Barra sitting in the GM and you're betting all these billions of dollars, personally, I think they're jumping the gun on electric vehicles, and probably people are going to think I'm crazy saying that. But I think there's a lot more life in internal combustion than we think. They're selling them like crazy. Those cars are going to be around for a while until. They're practical. I think the American people are going to either be embarrassed into electric vehicles or forced into them, but I think there's going to be a little time on that yet.
And let me add on what I said. I'm not predicting that they're right around the corner at this point, and this is why you're seeing what you're seeing with GM closing plants and letting go white-collar workers, Ford in its fitness initiative, and Fiat Chrysler apparently looking for partners, because they've got to spend money on this future technology, but they also have to spend money on what's making the money, the pickups and the SUVs. And at this point, they show no signs of letting any of that go. That's why you've got X amount of money for product development. That's why these companies aren't developing small cars, because they can no longer afford to have them as loss leaders, but they're not giving up on that. But what some analysts who watch transmissions and engine programs say, they're not spending much on actual product development of new transmissions and new engines. We are in the final stage of developing those. They can continue building what they have right now, but they're not spending the billions to do that, because they're spending that on electrification, because there are two things that have to make electrification worthwhile. One is cutting the cost, and the other is cutting the recharging time. Those are the two big deals. If you get it cheaper than a regular car, and if you can fill it up with electricity as fast as you can fill it up with gasoline, then there's no penalty for somebody to buy one.
And what we're seeing today, by the way, hands if anybody has a question, and we'll get a microphone to you. What we're seeing today is that every day it seems like there's some kind of alliance, some kind of merger, some kind of partnership, some kind of management shuffle taking place behind the scenes. And I throw this out to anybody, especially Jeff, because you cover this all the time. And I'm just wondering, do they really have a plan and know what they're doing, or are they just trying to touch a little bit of everything because anything could pop and we want to be there when it happens and we'll go with this if it works and forget about that?
Do they have a plan and do they know what they're doing? Which of those questions do you want me to answer first? Obviously, yes, they have a plan. All right, let me, here. I got $1 billion in my wallet. I'm going to give it to you. Somewhere, you've got to make a bet. There are no sure bets. So do they know what they're doing? Well, if their bet pays off, they're a genius. If their bet doesn't pay off, they're an idiot. If we're having this conversation in 2008, we are all certain that small cars are going to be hot and gas prices are going nowhere but up. Those were sure bets 10 years ago, and it didn't happen. So essentially, the big casinos are not necessarily Greektown, Motor City, and MGM Grand. The big casinos in Detroit are GM, Ford, and Fiat Chrysler. That's where the big bets are made. And they try to do it as educated as possible, but nobody has a crystal ball.
If I were doing a news report on this, I would be using that sound clip right there. That's a good one. We have a question all the way in the back. Yes.
Okay. Hi. So this, I actually don't know how to ask this question, so I'm just going to try to do as best as I can. So there are So there are a lot of OEMs and manufacturers of vehicles who are moving production, say, to the States or other countries. But then there's also other countries that are bringing their manufacturing here. But I guess, are domestic brands prepared for other countries to bring their production here, or even, say, China, who, if I remember right, is starting to produce a lot more vehicles nowadays? Is America ready for a chance that, say, China could start bringing their own vehicles here, and do they have a plan for that sort of thing?
Anybody want to go with that?
I read a fascinating story about China and manufacturing, and one of the reasons, I mean, you go back 10 years, you saw those little Chinese cars at the auto show. They started to appear. Some were kind of cute. People nicknamed them Teletubby mobiles, and others looked realistic, and they didn't really take off. They didn't take off then because it was hard for the Chinese manufacturers to crack the code of U.S. regulations, but this article also said that they didn't happen then because the Chinese market was growing so much, so it just wasn't worth spending all that money to develop vehicles for the U.S. when you could make them and sell them so much easier in your home market. China's slowing down, so the U.S. is of more interest, but Chinese manufacturers took a new tactic. They started buying suppliers, so they're well within the U.S. manufacturing as owners of suppliers, and they've slowly started investing in and buying car companies. There's a large Chinese investment, I believe, in Daimler. I'm not 100% sure, but I think there's a pretty large investment there, and they own Volvo, and they're making some boutique car makers. So it's a different strategy. And I had somebody at the National Automobile Dealers Association tell me that the reason they so vociferously fought Tesla in terms of selling without dealerships is they wanted to send a message to Chinese car makers who were coming in bigger numbers that they couldn't do the same thing without a fight. So it's not just the auto industry and the supply base, but it's other businesses as well.
Question from the back. Yes.
On the button. Two questions, really, back to electric cars. First of all, is the electrical infrastructure in place for everybody in my neighborhood, for example, to have an electric car? And I think it's interesting you mentioned that the technology, it has to be there, the recharge time has to be cut. But back to that, is the infrastructure there for everyone, like I say, in my neighborhood to have an electric car? As I understand it, you need to have like a 240-volt outlet, like an electric dryer or something like that to make it viable. Is that in place? And just a comment, I heard recently that the thought is that electric cars will be in the mainstream in 10 years or so. Is that something that's really coming that quickly? So sorry for the two questions, but that's what I have.
So electrical
infrastructure, and is it really possible that electric cars will be in the mainstream in 10 years or so?
I don't know about the second question, but I'll try the first one. So my answer is no and no. Today, if you buy a Tesla and you drive, and let's say you live in Birmingham, you cannot make it to downtown Chicago on one charge. You have to stop at the fast charge station in Gary, Indiana, that takes about 30 minutes to fast charge your car.
So from Birmingham to downtown Chicago is roughly 4.5 hours. So you're adding a half hour. Now you get to downtown Chicago and you do your thing there and you have to drive back. You don't have enough of a charge to get back. So you have to stop at Gary on your way back. And if there isn't a charging station available there in Gary, you have to wait. So the infrastructure is not there yet. For example, my office in downtown Birmingham, I park in the city structure. You would think in downtown Birmingham, in the city structures, that they would have charging available for cars. They do not. You go into the city in Detroit, there's some structures that do have it available. So that's number one. Number two, there isn't a universal plug to charge every electric car. So a Nissan is different than a Tesla, that's different from a Ford. So there's a problem there when you get into public charging places, and that's the variety of the plugs that go into your car. The second thing, and this is simply my opinion, is the battery technology today, I think, is one of the barriers for us to mass accept electric vehicles. When the range of electric vehicles, let's say, can get to 500 miles or above, I think our mindset as consumers will change. Because 500 miles is a pretty good distance. That may allow me to drive to downtown Chicago and back on one charge and get it back into my garage so I can charge it. But now it's a response cost on my part. If I'm buying an electric vehicle as a consumer, I have to say, okay, if I'm not simply commuting to downtown Detroit or wherever it is that I work and back home, and I can charge it at night in my garage, this just has fallen into the it isn't worth it category for me as a consumer. That paired with the fact now that the tax incentives are being reduced by half really has reduced, you know, when you take an incentive away, what happens? Sales go down. So that battery technology and infrastructure, to your point, I think are two key points to really get electric vehicles more and more ingrained into what people drive on a day-to-day basis.
And I'd like to thank you for asking that question today especially. Does anybody know what today's the anniversary of? 3 Mile Island happened 40 years ago today. Wow. Kind of a key event in the history of the electrical infrastructure, and that's another issue that needs to be brought up. If you have 220-volt charging stations at everybody's house, we need to make sure that the grid is ready for it as well.
What a great memory. Thank you.
I heard it on WWJ this morning.
Everything that we're talking about today means that somebody has to sell the product and somebody has to put teams together to do that. Alana, you have told me that you have to really try to figure out where an industry is going in order to know how to build your team and work and actually infiltrate your market so that you can sell your products.
Yeah, and there was a lot of discussion even about millennials, right? So we talked a lot about what salespeople need. We haven't talked a lot about what sales management and sales leadership needs. In any organization, regardless of sales, the amount of effort that organizations put at training, management, and above level is pathetic. There was an article, I think, in Harvard Business Review, and I'll probably screw up the statistic. It was something like 46%, don't quote me exactly, of companies invest in training and developing the managers and leaders, because often what happens, we take our top performers, sales or any other function, and they do really well in their role, and we say, guess what, you're promoted, you're now a manager. But we haven't given them the management skills, which are completely different than the doing skills to be able to be successful. So a lot of times what we have, sometimes retention is more they're leaving the people or the manager than they're leaving the company, because the managers today don't have what they need to really be effective coaches. Any manager can say, go do that, or you should have done this, or I would have done that. That's not an effective strategy to grow and retain people. They really have to get good at coaching, which is very much an art and a science and is a skill that's missing in a lot of organizations, the management and leadership level.
Do you go into organizations and say the manager has to go?
Sometimes. That sales middle manager is often the biggest problem. The sales director or the sales VP may be strong, but the sales manager is missing what they need. So it's a question of, can we develop it, or is it not how they're wired? So those are the types of things we need to use some assessments and some training and develop around to figure out.
All right, before we wrap this thing up, somebody in the back, yes.
Yep. Hi again. I'm going to talk louder this time. Back to the topic of millennials and that sort of thing, I want to ask a question about social media in terms of the automotive industry and whether or not, personally, I mean, this is more my opinion, but I think social media is not really as great as people say it is, and it kind of sucks, really. But when it comes to social media being used by, maybe suppliers or manufacturers, does that help or hurt them? Because some things that come to mind would be, say, when Elon Musk did that on Twitter, I can't remember exactly what it was, but it apparently changed the price of his stock market shares in Tesla and that sort of thing. There's a whole fiasco about it, but where do you see social media moving forward in the industry, helping or hurting it, or maybe just disrupting it for better or worse?
Probably starting with advertising, and I'm thinking of the auto shows, because the auto shows are now going social. Rather than put a big display out at an auto show, we see the automakers going to social media and unveiling their vehicles there and getting hits all over the place.
It's a tool, like any other. A tool can be used well, a tool can be used poorly. I mean, Elon Musk likes to communicate via social media. If he says the right things, we're fine. Where he got into trouble was he didn't follow what were standard Securities and Exchange Commission practices. I mean, you wouldn't necessarily blab about plans to a friend about something, because that gets people in trouble with insider trading. So you follow the rules, it can be done well. People at GM are great with social media.
Joe, real quick question about LinkedIn, job boards, that type of thing. How does that play out
in recruiting? And I was mentioning this before the program started, I was talking to Mr. Weinberg about it. The technology out there now, from a recruiting standpoint, pretty much allows us to identify just about anybody. It's not hard to find a candidate with LinkedIn and social media and all the marketing tools that are out there. But that's just about 20%, of the equation. As a recruiter, we're trying to find a top-flight candidate who's gainfully employed and really successful. Obviously, that's what a client would want. So the trick is to recruit that person and bring them from a passive candidate all the way through a process of recruiting and moving them through to finally leaving their company and joining a new company. And what we're finding with our clients is we try to teach them to hire the best athlete. Don't worry about, well, they have to have this education and this amount of experience and this product knowledge. Yes, those are prices of entry. But we look for the people that have the right attitude, will fit into the organization, have the right motivation for change, want the job for the right reasons. None of those things are on the resume. And that's the reason someone will hire a person, not just the resume itself or the qualifications. So the social media, the LinkedIn and so forth is great in identifying people, but it really takes the professionals, if you will, to extract that information and bring the person through the process.
All right, we have a couple more questions here, but first, Jeff, do you have to leave?
I do. I have to.
Jeff has to leave because he's going to Ford Motor Company.
So thank you very much.
And I promised him that if he gave us an hour of his time, he would get out and in time to go to Ford Motor Company and have that on the air this afternoon. Thank you very much, Jeff Gilbert, for being with us today. All right, I kept that promise. Now another promise. Yes.
So I just want to make sure that I'm going to ask this question the right way. So you guys were talking about the technology of the electronic car not going as fast as it needed to be because of the lack of charging stations, some of the charging stations. Has the big three taken a look and started thinking out of the box? I don't know whether you'll know this or not, about promoting selling the charging stations to corporations to push their employees to start looking at electric cars. So they have actual have charging stations at their corporations.
I think the utilities have already begun doing some of that, but does anybody, I don't know about the
militaries. Military's done that. I think various community, you know, municipalities have done a lot of that too with their vehicles. But what's interesting to me is that I think who should be looking at charging stations is the is gas stations. Okay, because right now I've never pulled into a gas station and seen where I can plug my car in. So where do people go to refuel their car? Gas stations, you know, which have turned into little supermarkets. So why not put a charging station? I mean, you're able to capture revenue. Margins are low enough on gas. You know, they're making a penny a gallon. That's why you can buy milk, bread, coffee, lottery tickets, etc. now at gas stations, because you're making a penny a gallon or whatever it is. Put a charging station in. You know, they're already charging for air for your tires. Why not charge for electricity? I'm shocked that we haven't seen that yet.
I am shocked that you have to pay for air, too. I couldn't believe that when that happened. Well, we pay for water, so why not, right?
Hey, good morning, guys. So, electric car owner, and I've taken it to California and back, and the infrastructure is getting there. So that's for an electric vehicle. But what I want to hear more about is for an autonomous vehicle, there still has to be huge investments in infrastructure, lanes being well marked, roads and bridges obviously not having incredible potholes, and also wireless networks that will support base stations where vehicle-to-vehicle and vehicle-to-base can also exist. So what about the, you know...
I rode in an autonomous vehicle this past year right in Farmington Hills. The technology is there, and it wasn't some kind of a mock-up mule, as they say. It was a fully loaded SUV with leather seats and power windows and ready to go. Built by a foreign supplier. The technology is there, but I think there's a lot of roads to cross before we get to the point where they're an everyday occurrence on the road. I'm not an expert at that, but you know, from what I hear and read and talk to different people, it's the actual implementation into the real world with all the things that the legal and structural ramifications is going to be a way off. But the technology, they can do it right now. They're out there right now. They can't identify, like in certain climates, like in the northern climates, they mistake certain things for other things. There are just so many things that have to happen. I'm not really sure how that's going to evolve.
And latest government studies show that when there is a curve or a fork in the road, it is difficult for the autonomous car to navigate that and to see that. And they're still working on trying to identify pedestrians and trying to identify motorcycles, too. What's the difference between a motorcycle and a police car as it goes fast? Some autonomous vehicle testing has shown that's still a big problem. So before we get to all the infrastructure, we got to get them talking together. And the vehicles, we talk about connectivity. Yeah, they're connected, but we have a long way to go with that one before it happens, too. But the researchers say it's moving at rapid pace with those initiatives. Rich, one more question, and then we're going to...
Tomorrow's workforce, based on what Joe was saying about recruiting people, should there, and I guess this question maybe is for each one of you, your own independent views of it, do you believe the people that are going to be in the workforce of tomorrow should be brought in with a base set of requirements and the industry should train them? Or should they rely more on what the system is currently offering by taking people from other companies, looking at the education system? I know that will always exist. But is the new shift to technology going to require that the car companies and the suppliers make a mind shift and bring up workers to the level they need as opposed to trying to find them?
They're going to need both. It depends a lot on the position. But there's certain technical positions like embedded software engineers, for example. I'm not sure we have any born and bred Americans that, in any quantity that can do that. And we have all kinds of immigration situations trying to get some of these technical people into the country. there's going to be a lot of technical disciplines where they're going to have to be retrained or get training for those specific technical disciplines. So I think it's a good idea that companies do try to develop their own, especially in some of the technical areas.
But Alan, it's changing all the time. You have to continue to grasp it because it's continuing to change, and it means you have to have different skills to go out there and do what you do.
Yeah, absolutely, and I think your answer of it has to have both is perfect, right? I think organizations are lacking sometimes on how do we really develop, how do we show the path, and that's what the younger workers want, right? We've talked about it already. The studies are all out there that they want the path for future development. It's not necessarily throw money, more money at them. That's not how they're motivated. So we've got to be able to identify the path, develop the path, build a bench, which in a lot of organizations doesn't exist, right? How are we taking these people and what are we doing to groom them up into the next level versus just bringing in somebody from the outside, which is often needed sometimes too. But how are we developing versus just poaching?
And it's all about change. And as we wrap this up, Sheldon, where are we in the change? Are we at the beginning still? Are we in the middle of the change? That's a tough question.
Yeah. Thanks, Murray. obviously, it's accelerating. Change in the auto industry is accelerating. There is much more of valuing differences and willing to explore different alternatives in the industry today than there were 10 years ago. There's critical thinking within organizations is not being suppressed. It's rising to the top. So when you have those two characteristics in an organization, you have change that's accelerating, and you pair that with the technology that is currently integrated and will accelerate the development of whether you're talking about stage five electric vehicles or rather autonomous vehicles or better electric vehicles, you'll see an acceleration of that. So we are not necessarily in an embryonic stage. We are closer to the beginning than we are being full adopters of the technology because it's simply not there yet, whether it's with respect to what lies in the automobiles or what lies in the infrastructures. But you'll see an increased rate of adoption and the technology.
Sheldon Stone, Alana Nickel, Joe Jockman, thank you very much for being with
Thanks
us.
Very
Jeff
much.
Gilbert, too. Thank you all for being with us. I hope you found it enjoyable and also informative. I certainly did. We hope that you'll be with us for our next event. It's April the 18th, a Thursday morning. We will have women on stage who have risen to the top of their field. They'll talk about how they've done it and the contributions they're making to metropolitan Detroit and our economy and our community socially as well. So that's April 18th. More details and reserve your seat. It's all free at wwjnewsradio.com. Thank you so much. We'll talk to you later. Bye-bye.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto-pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto-pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well-qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.